One Eye testify to his rapid journey down the railroad embankment the other night. He is shaking hands with his well-wishers, booming male endearments, paying special attention to the Russians. Well, bet you've spiked that with a little vodka, huh? Moving on. Vlad, fella, how's your ass? The Russians do not appear to understand, which leaves them only the fanged smile, the Easter egg eyes, to make sense of. Slothrop is just snorting foam out of his nose when Marvy spots him and those eyes bug out in earnest. There he is, in a great roar, indicating Slothrop with a trembling finger. By God, the limey son of a bitch, go get him, boys, go get him, boys. Slothrop, continuing to gaze a moment here at this finger illuminated in cute flourishes and curlicues of cherubic fat. There, there, my man, begins Ian, scuffling, by which point hostile faces have begun to close in. Oh, that's right. Escape. He sloshes beer at the head nearest, heaves the empty shell case at another, finds a gap in the crowd, slithers through and flees across florid faces of drunks asleep, vaulting khaki paunches festooned with splashes of vomit, away down the deep cross-tunnel among the pieces of rocket. Reveille, you hammerheads, Marvy's screaming. Don't let that sucker get away. A sergeant with a boy's face and gray hair, dozing with a grease gun cradled against him, wakes up crying, Krauts! Lets loose a deafening burst from his weapon straight into the beer barrel, which destroys the bottom half and sends a great gush of wet amber and foam surging among the pursuing Americans, half of whom promptly slip and go down on their ass. Flothrop reaches the other end of the Stollen with a good lead and goes sprinting up a ladder there, taking rungs two at a time. Shots! Terrific blasts in this sound box. Either Marvy's mothers are too drunk or the darkness is saving him. He hits the top out of breath. In the other main tunnel now, Slothrop falls into a jog down the long mile to the outside, trying not to wonder if he has the wind to make it. He hasn't gone 200 feet when the vanguard comes clambering up off of that ladder behind him. He dodges into what must be a paint shop, skids on a patch of wet Wehrmacht green, and goes down, proceeding through big splashes of black, white, and red before coming to rest against the combat boots of an elderly man in a tweed suit with white water buffalo mustaches. Grüß Gott. Say, I think they're trying to kill me back there. Is there someplace? The old man winks, motions Slothrop through the Stollen and on into the other main tunnel. Slothrop notices a pair of coveralls streaked with paint and thinks to grab them. Past four more Stollen, then a sharp right. It's a metal storage area. Watch this, the old man goes chuckling down the long shop among blue racks of cold rolled sheets, heaps of aluminum ingots, sheafs of 3712 bar stock, 1624, 723. This is going to be good. Not that way, man. That's the one they're coming down. But this oversized elf already has set about hitching cable from a hoist overhead to a tall bundle of Monel bars. Slothrop climbs into those coveralls, combs his pompadour down over his forehead, takes out a pocket knife, and saws off pieces of mustache on both sides. You look like Hitler now. Now they will really want to kill you. German humor. He introduces himself as Glimpf, professor of mathematics of the Technische Hochschule, Darmstadt, scientific advisor to the Allied military government, which takes a while. Now, we bring them this way. I am in the hands of a raving maniac. Why not just hide out in here till they forget it? But here comes dim shouts up tunnel now. All clear in 37 and 38, Chucky babes. Okay, old hoss, you guys take odds, we'll take evens. They are not going to forget it. They are making a tunnel-by-tunnel search. Instead, it's peacetime. They can't shoot you in peacetime, but they're drunk. Oh, boy. Slothrop is scared shitless. What do we do? You will be the expert in idiomatic English. Say something provocative. Slothrop sticks his head out in the long tunnel and hollers in his most English accent, Major Marvy Sachs! Up this way! Sounds of galloping GI boots, nail heads smacking the concrete, and a lot of other ominous metal, too, going snick, snick. Now, beams mischievous Glimpf, setting the hoist in motion. A fresh thought occurs to Slothrop. He puts his head back out and hollers, Major Marvy Sachs niggers! I think we should hurry, says Glimpf. Oh, I just thought of a good one about his mother. Black has been disappearing inch by inch from the bite of cable between the hoist and the bar stock, which Glimpf has rigged to topple across the doorway, hopefully about the time the Americans show up. Slothrop and Glimpf light out through the opposite exit. About the time they reach the first curve in the tunnel, all the lights go out. The ventilation winds on. The phantom voices inside it gain confidence from the dark. The bundle of Monell falls with a great crash. Slothrop touches rock wall and uses the wall then for guidance through this absolute blackness. Glimpf is still someplace in the middle of the tunnel on the tracks. He is not breathing hard, but he is chuckling to himself. Behind are the hollow staggerings of the pursuit, but no light yet. There is a soft clang and sharp Himmel from the old professor. Sounds of yelling have grown louder, and now here are the first flashlights, and it's time to get out of the bathtub. What's happening, for Christ's sake? Come here. Glimpf has collided with some kind of miniature train, just visible now in outline. It was used once to show visitors from Berlin around the factory. They climb aboard the tractor in front, and Glimpf fiddles with switches. Well, here we go, all aboard. Lights must have been all that Marvy cut. Sparks are crackling out behind, and there's even a little wind now. Good to be rolling. Every little Nazi's shooting pool or playing potsy on the Mittelwerk Express. All the funny fascists just a-twirling their mustaches. Where we going, can't you guess? Heading for the country, just down the tracks. Never heard of shortages or income tax. Gonna be good times for Minnie and Max on the Mittelwerk Express. Glimpf has switched on a headlamp. From side tunnels booming by, figures in khaki stare. Whites of eyes give back the light for an instant before flicking past. A few people wave. Shouts go dopplering, hey, hey, like car horns at the crossings going home at night on the Boston and Maine. The express is rolling at a fair clip. Damp wind rushes by in a whistle. In the lamp's backscatter, silhouettes of warhead sections can be made out, stacked on the two little flat cars the engine's towing. Local midgetry scuttle and cringe alongside the tracks, nearly out of the light. They think of the little train as their own and feel hurt whenever the big people come to commandeer it. Some sit on stacks of crates dangling their legs. Some practice handstands in the dark. Their eyes glow green and red. Some even swing from ropes, secured to the overhead in mock kamikaze attacks on Glimpf and Slothrop, screaming, "Banzai! Banzai!" before vanishing with a giggle. It's all in play. They're really quite an amiable... Right behind, loud as megaphones in massed chorale, "There once was a fellow named Slattery." "Oh, shit," says Slothrop. "Who was fond of the coarse gyro battery. With that 50-volt shock, what was left of his cock was all slimy and sloppy and spattery. Ja, 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 ja. In Prussia they never eat pussy, und so weiter." "Can you get back and uncouple those cars?" Glimpf wants to know. "Reckon so." But he seems to fumble at it for hours. Meantime, there was a young fellow named Pope who plugged into an oscilloscope. The cyclical trace of their carnal embrace had a damn nearly infinite slope. "Engineers," Glimpf mutters. Slothrop gets the cars uncoupled and the engine speeds up. Wind is tearing at all Irish pennants, collar points, cuffs, buckles, and belts. Back behind them there's a tremendous crash and clank and a few shouts in the dark. "Think that stopped them?" "Right up their ass in four-part harmony. There was a young fellow named Yuri, fucked the nozzle right up its venturi. He had woes without cease from his local police and a hell of a time with the jury." "Okay, Joppo babes. Got that old phosphorus flare? Stand by, good buddy." With only that warning, in blinding concussion, the icy Noctiluca breaks, floods through the white tunnel. For a minute or two, nobody in here can see. There is only the hurtling on through amazing, perfect whiteness. Whiteness without heat and blind inertia. Slothrop feels a terrible familiarity here, a center he has been skirting, avoiding as long as he can remember. Never has he been as close as now to the true momentum of his time. Faces and facts that have crowded his indenture to the rocket. Camouflage and distraction fall away from the white moment. The vain and blind tugging at his sleeves. "It's important. Please look at us." But it's already too late. It's only wind, only G-loads. And the blood of his eyes has begun to touch the whiteness back to ivory, to brushings of gold and a network of edges to the broken rock. And the hand that lifted him away sets him back in the Mittelwerke. Whoo-wee! There's that sucker now! Out of the flare, inside easy pistol range, emerges a lumbering diesel engine, pushing ahead of it the two cars Slothrop uncoupled, itself stuffed with bloodshot, disheveled, bloated Americans, and at an apex perched lopsided on their shoulders, Major Marvy himself wearing a giant white Stetson and clutching two .45 automatics. Slothrop ducks down behind a cylindrical object at the rear of the tractor. Marvy starts shooting wildly, inspired by hideous laughter from the others. Slothrop happens to notice now that what he's chosen to hide behind actually seems to be another warhead. If the Amatol charges are still in, say, Professor, could the shockwave from a 45 bullet at this range succeed in detonating this warhead here if it struck the casing? Even if there was no fuse installed? Well, Tyrone, now that would depend on many things. Muzzle velocity, wall thickness, and composition. Counting at least on a pulled arm muscle and hernia, Slothrop manages to tip and heave the warhead off onto the track while Marvey's bullets go whanging and crashing all over the tunnel. It bounces and comes to rest, tilted against one of the rails. Good. The flare has begun to die. Shadows are reoccupying the mouths of the Stollen. The cars ahead of Marvey hit the obstacle a solid wonk, doubling up in an inverted V. Diesel brakes screech in panic. Yike! As the big engine derails, slews begins to tip, Americans grabbing frantically for handholds, each other, empty air. Then Slothrop and Glimpf are around the last curve of the integral sign, and there is another huge crash behind them, screaming that prolongs, echoing as they see now the entrance ahead, growing parabola of green mountain slopes and sunlight. "Did you have a car when you came?" inquires the twinkling Glimpf. "What?" Slothrop recalls the keys still in that Mercedes. "Oh!" Glimpf eases on the brakes as they coast out under the parabola into daylight and roll to a smooth and respectable stop. They flip salutes at the B Company sentries and proceed to hijack the Mercedes, which is right where that rail left it. Out on the road, Glimpf gestures them north, watching Slothrop's driving with a leery eye. They wind snarling up into the Harz, in and out of mountain shadows, pine and fir odors enveloping them, screeching around curves and sometimes nearly off of the road. Slothrop has the inborn gift of selecting the wrong gear for all occasions. And anyhow, he's jittery, eye in the mirror, and out the back of his head a swarm with souped-up personnel carriers and squadrons of howling thunderbolts. Coming around a blind corner, using the whole width of the pavement to make it, a sharp road-racing trick he happens to know, they nearly buy it from a descending American Army deuce and a half, the words "fucking idiot" clearly visible on the mouth of the driver as they barely scoot past. Heartbeats slamming low in their throats, mud from the truck's rear tires slapping over them in a great wing that shakes the rig and blots out half the windshield. The sun is well past its zenith when they pull up, finally, below a forested dome with a small dilapidated castle on top, hundreds of doves, white teardrops dripping from its battlements. The green breath of the woods has sharpened, grown colder. They climb a switchbacking path strewn with rocks among dark firs toward the castle in the sunlight, jagged and brown above as a chunk of bread left out for all its generations of birds. "This is where you're staying?"
"I used to work here. I think Zwitter might still be around."
There wasn't enough room in the Mittelwerke for many of the smaller assembly jobs, control systems mainly, so they were put together in beer halls, shops, schools, castles, farmhouses all around Nordhausen here, any indoor lab space the guidance people could find.
Glimpf's colleague Zwitter is from the TH in Munich.
"The usual Bavarian approach to electronics," Glimpf begins to frown. "He's bearable, I suppose." Whatever mysterious injustices spring from a Bavarian approach to electronics now remove Glimpf's twinkle and keep him occupied in surly introspection the rest of the way up. Mass liquid cooing, damped in white fluff, greets them as they slip in a side entrance to the castle. Floors are dirty and littered with bottles and scraps of papers. Some of the papers are stamped with the magenta Geheime Kommandosache. Birds fly in and out of broken windows. Thin beams of light come in from chinks and erosions. Dust motes, fanned by the dove's wings, never stop billowing here. Walls are hung with dim portraits of nobles in big white Frederick the Great hairdos, ladies with smooth faces and oval eyes in low-necked dresses whose yards of silk spill out into the dust and wingbeats of the dark rooms. There is dove shit all over the place. By contrast, Zwitter's laboratory upstairs is brightly lit. Well-ordered, crammed with blown glass, work tables, lights of many colors, speckled boxes, green folders, a mad Nazi scientist lab. "Plastic man, where are you?"
"There's only Zwitter."
Stocky, dark hair parted down the middle, eyeglass lenses thick as the windows of a bathysphere, the fluorescent hydras, eels, and rays of control equations swimming seas behind them. But when they see Slothrop, there is immediate clearing there, and glazed barriers come down. P.S. What's this? Who are these people? What's happened to the apples in old Glimpf's cheeks?
What's a Nazi guidance expert doing this side of the fence at Garmisch with his lab intact?
Oh, there's Nazis in the woodwork, fascists in the walls. Little Japs with bucktooth grins are gonna grab you by the balls. When this war is over, how happy I will be, gearing up for them riskies and go round number three. In the days when the white engineers were disputing the attributes of the feeder system that was to be, one of them came to Enzian of Bleicherode and said, "We cannot agree on the chamber pressure. Our calculations show that a working pressure of 40 atu would be the most desirable, but all the data we know of are grouped around a value of only some 10 atu."
"Then clearly," replied the Nguaroreru, "you must listen to the data."
"But that would not be the most perfect or efficient value," protested the German.
"Proud man," said the Nguaroreru. "What are these data if not direct revelation? Where have they come from if not from the rocket which is to be? How do you presume to compare a number you have only derived on paper with a number that is the rocket's own? Avoid pride and design to some compromise value."
From Tales of the Schwarzkommando, collected by Steve Adelman. In the mountains around Nordhausen and Bleicherode, down in abandoned mine shafts, live the Schwarzkommando. These days it's no longer a military title. They are a people now, Zone Hereros, in exile for two generations from Southwest Africa. Early Rhenish missionaries began to bring them back to the metropolis, that great dull zoo, as specimens of a possibly doomed race. They were gently experimented with, exposed to cathedrals, Wagnerian soirees, Jaeger underwear, trying to get them interested in their souls. Others were taken back to Germany as servants, by soldiers who went to put down the great Herero Rising of 1904 to 1906. But only after 1933 did most of the present-day leadership arrive as part of a scheme, never openly admitted by the Nazi Party, for setting up black juntas, shadow states for the eventual takeover of British and French colonies in Black Africa, on the model of Germany's plan for the Maghreb. Sud-West, by then, was a protectorate administered by the Union of South Africa, but the real power was still with the old German colonial families. And they cooperated. There are several underground communities now near Nordhausen, Bleicherode. Around here they are known collectively as the Erdschweinhöhle. There is a Herero joke, a bitter one. Among the Obajimba, the poorest of the Hereros, with no cattle or villages of their own, the totem animal was the Erdschwein, or aardvark. They took their name from him, never ate his flesh, dug their food from the earth just as he does. Considered outcasts, they lived on the veldt in the open. You were likely to come across them at night, their fires flaring bravely against the wind, out of rifle range from the iron tracks. There seemed no other force than that to give them locus out in that emptiness. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 11. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 366. You knew what they feared, not what they wanted or what moved them. And you had business up country at the mines, so presently, as the sputtering light slipped behind, so did all further need to think of them. But as you swung away, who was the woman alone in the earth, planted up to her shoulders in the aardvark hole, a gazing head rooted to the desert plain, with an upsweep of mountains far behind her, darkly folded, far away in the evening? She can feel the incredible pressure, miles of horizontal sand and clay against her belly. Down the trail wait the luminous ghosts of her four stillborn children, fat worms lying with no chances of comfort among the wild onions, one by one crying for milk more sacred than what is tasted and blessed in the village calabashes. In preterite line they have pointed her here, to be in touch with Earth's gift for Genesis. The woman feels power flood in through every gate, a river between her thighs, light leaping at the ends of fingers and toes. It is sure and nourishing as sleep. It is a warmth. The more the daylight fades, the further she submits to the dark, to the descent of water from the air. She is a seed in the earth. The holy aardvark has dug her bed. back in Südwest, the Erdschweinhöhle was a powerful symbol of fertility and life. But here in the zone, its real status is not so clear. Inside the Schwarzkommando, there are forces at present who have opted for sterility and death. The struggle is mostly in silence, in the night, in the nauseas and crampings of pregnancies or miscarriages. But it is political struggle. No one is more troubled with it than Enzian. He is in Guaroreru here. The word doesn't mean leader exactly, but one who has been proven. Enzian is also known, though not to his face, as Otikondo, the half-breed. His father was a European. Not that it makes him unique among the Erdschweinhörlers here. There's German, Slavic, and Gypsy blood mixed in by now, too. Over the couple of generations, moved by accelerations unknown in the days before the Empire, they have been growing an identity that few can see as ever taking final shape. The rocket will have a final shape, but not its people. The Anda and Oruzo have lost their force out here. The bloodlines of mother and father were left behind in Südwest. Many of the early immigrants had even gone over to the faith of the Rhenish Missionary Society long before they left. In each village, as noon flared the shadows in tightly to their owners, in that moment of terror and refuge, the Omu Hona took from his sacred bag soul after converted soul, the leather cord kept there since the individual's birth, and untied the birth knot. Untied, it was another soul dead to the tribe. So today, in the Erdschweinhöhle, the empty ones each carry one knotless strip of leather. It is a bit of the old symbolism they have found useful. They call themselves Otukungurua. Yes, old Africa hands, it ought to be Omakungurua, but they are always careful. Perhaps it's less healthy than care to point out that Oma applies only to the living and human. Otu is for the inanimate and the rising, and this is how they imagine themselves. Revolutionaries of the Zero, they mean to carry on what began among the old Hereros after the 1904 rebellion failed. They want a negative birth rate. The program is racial suicide. They would finish the extermination the Germans began in 1904. A generation earlier, the declining number of live Herero births was a topic of medical interest throughout southern Africa. The whites looked on as anxiously as they would have at an outbreak of Rinderpest among the cattle. How provoking to watch one's subject population dwindling like this year after year. What's a colony without its dusky natives? Where's the fun if they're all going to die off? Just a big hunk of desert, no more maids, no field hands, no laborers for the construction or the mining. Wait a minute there. Yes, it's Karl Marx, that sly old racist, skipping away with his teeth together and his eyebrows up, trying to make believe it's nothing but cheap labor and overseas markets. Oh, no. Colonies are much, much more. Colonies are the outhouses of the European soul, where a fellow can let his pants down and relax, enjoy the smell of his own shit, where he can fall on his slender prey, roaring as loud as he feels like, and guzzle her blood with open joy, eh? Where he can just wallow and rut and let himself go in a softness, a receptive darkness of limbs, of hair as woolly as the hair on his own forbidden genitals. Where the poppy and cannabis and coca grow full and green, and not to the colors and style of death as do ergot and agaric, the blight and fungus native to Europe. Christian Europe was always death, Karl, death and repression. Out and down in the colonies, life can be indulged, life and sensuality in all its forms, with no harm done to the metropolis, nothing to soil those cathedrals, white marble statues, noble thoughts. No word ever gets back. The silences down here are vast enough to absorb all behavior, no matter how dirty, how animal it gets. Some of the more rational men of medicine attributed the Herero birth decline to a deficiency of vitamin E in the diet. Others to poor chances of fertilization given the peculiarly long and narrow uterus of the Herero female. But underneath all this reasonable talk, this scientific speculating, no white Afrikaner could quite put down the way it felt. Something sinister was moving out in the veld. He was beginning to look at their faces, especially those of the women, lined beyond the thorn fences, and he knew beyond logical proof there was a tribal mind at work out here, and it had chosen to commit suicide. Puzzling. Perhaps we weren't as fair as we might have been. Perhaps we did take their cattle and their lands away, and then the work camps, of course, the barbed wire and the stockades. Perhaps they feel it is a world they no longer want to live in. Typical of them, though, giving up, crawling away to die. Why won't they even negotiate? We could work out a solution, some solution. It was a simple choice for the Hereros between two kinds of death, tribal death or Christian death. Tribal death made sense. Christian death made none at all. It seemed an exercise they did not need. But to the Europeans, conned by their own baby Jesus con game, what they were witnessing among these Hereros was a mystery potent as that of the elephant graveyard or the lemmings rushing into the sea. Though they don't admit it, the empty ones, now exiled in the zone, Europeanized in language and thought, split off from the old tribal unity, have found the why of it just as mysterious. But they've seized it, as a sick woman will seize a charm. They calculate no cycles, no returns. They are in love with the glamour of a whole people's suicide, the pose, the stoicism, and the bravery. These Otukungurua are prophets of masturbating, specialists in abortion and sterilization, pitchmen for acts oral and anal, pedal and digital, sodomistical and zoophiliac. Their approach and their game is pleasure. They are spieling earnestly and well, and Erdschweinherrlers are listening. The empty ones can guarantee a day when the last Zone Herrera will die, a final zero to a collective history fully lived. It has appeal. There is no outright struggle for power. It is all seduction and counter-seduction, advertising and pornography, and the history of the Zone Hereros is being decided in bed. Vectors in the night underground, all trying to flee a center, a force which appears to be the rocket. Some imagination, whether of journey or of destiny, which is able to gather violent political opposites together in the Erdschweinhöhle as it gathers fuel and oxidizer in its thrust chamber, metered, helmsman-like, for the sake of its scheduled parabola. Ensign sits this evening under his mountain. Behind him another day of schemes, expediting, newly invented paperwork, forms he manages to destroy or fold, Japanese style, before the day's end, into gazelles, orchids, hunter hawks. As the rocket grows toward its working shape and fullness, so does he evolve himself into a new configuration. He feels it. It's something else to worry about. Late last night, among the blueprints, Christian and Mieczyslav looked up, abruptly smiled, and fell silent. The transparent reverence. They study the drawings as if they were his own and revelations. This is not flattering to him. What Enzian wants to create will have no history. It will never need a design change. Time, as time is known to the other nations, will wither away inside this new one. The Erdschweinhöhle will not be bound like the rocket to time. The people will find the center again, the center without time, the journey without hysteresis, where every departure is a return to the same place, the only place. He has thus himself found a strange rapprochement with the empty ones, in particular with Josef Ombindi of Hanover. The eternal center can easily be seen as the final zero. Names and methods vary, but the movement toward stillness is the same. It has led to strange passages between the two men. You know? Ombindi's eyes rolled the other way, looking up at a mirror image of Ensign that only he can see. Well, something you ordinarily wouldn't think of as erotic, but it's really the most erotic thing there is. Really? Grins Ensign, flirting. I can't think of what that would be. Give me a clue. It's a non-repeatable act. Firing a rocket? No, because there's always another rocket. But there's nothing... Well, never mind. Ha! Nothing to follow it with. That's what you were going to say. Suppose I give you another clue. All right, but Enzian has already guessed. It's there in the way he holds his jaw and is just about to laugh. It embraces all the deviations in one single act. Enzian sighs, irritated, but does not call him on this use of deviations. Bringing up the past is part of Ombindi's game. Homosexuality, for example, no rise. Sadism and masochism. Onanism? Necrophilia? All those in the same act? all those and more. Both know by now that what's under discussion is the act of suicide, which also includes bestiality. Think how sweet, runs the pitch, to show mercy, sexual mercy, to that hurt and crying animal. Pedophilia. It is widely reported that just at the edge you grow glaringly younger. Lesbianism. Yes, for as the wind blows through all the emptying compartments, the two shadow women at last can creep out of their chambers in the dying shell at the last ashen shoreline to meet and embrace. Coprophilia and urolagnia, the final convulsions. Fetishism, a wide choice of death fetishes, naturally. Naturally. The two of them sit there passing a cigarette back and forth till it's smoked down to a very small stub. Is it idle talk? Or is Ombindi really trying to hustle Enzian here? Enzian's got to be sure before he moves. If he comes out, says, this is a hustle, right, and turns out it isn't, well, but the alternative is so strange that Enzian is, in some way, being sold on suicide. Well, I don't care for the things I eat. Can't stand that boogie-woogie beat, but I'm sold on suicide. You can keep their bingle, too, and that darn boo-boo-boo-boo, 'cause I'm sold on suicide. Oh, I'm not too keen on ration stamps or mothers who used to be baby vamps, but I'm sold on suicide. Don't like either the cards or browns. Piss on the country and piss on the town. But I'm S.O.S. Yes, well, actually, this goes on verse after verse for quite some time. In its complete version, it represents a pretty fair renunciation of the things of the world. The trouble with it is that by Gödel's theorem, there is bound to be some item around that one has omitted from the list, and such an item is not easy to think of off the top of one's head, so that what one does most likely is go back over the whole thing, meantime correcting mistakes and inevitable repetitions, and putting in new items that will surely have occurred to one, and, well, it's easy to see that the suicide of the title might have to be postponed indefinitely. Conversations between Ombindi and Enzian these days are thus a series of commercial messages, with Enzian not so much Mark as unwilling shill, standing in for the rest of the tip, who may be listening and maybe not.
Ah, do I see your cock growing in Gwalawiru? No, perhaps you are only thinking of someone you loved somewhere long ago, back in Sudwest, eh? To allow the tribal past to disperse all memories ought to be public record. There's no point in preserving history with that final zero to look forward to. Cynically, though, Ombindi has preached this in the name of the old tribal unity. And it's a weakness in his pitch, all right. It looks bad. Looks like Ombindi's trying to make believe the Christian sickness never touched us, when everyone knows it has infected us all, some to death. Yes, it is a little bit jive of Ombindi here to look back toward an innocence he's really only heard about. Can't himself believe in, the gathered purity of opposites, the village built like a mandala, still he will profess and proclaim it as an image of a grail slipping through the room. Radiant, though the jokers around the table be sneaking whoopee cushions into the siege perilous, under the very descending arse of the grail seeker, and though the grails themselves come in plastic these years, a dime a dozen, penny a gross, still Ombindi, at times self-conned as any Christian, praises and prophesies that era of innocence he just missed living in. One of the last pockets of pre-Christian oneness left on the planet. Tibet is a special case. Tibet was deliberately set aside by the Empire as free and neutral territory, as Switzerland for the spirit where there is no extradition, and Alp Himalayas to draw the soul upward and danger rare enough to tolerate. Switzerland and Tibet are linked along one of the true meridians of Earth. True as the Chinese have drawn meridians of the body, we will have to learn such new maps of Earth, and as travel in the interior becomes more common, as the maps grow another dimension, so must we. And he tells, too, of Gondwanaland, before the continents drifted apart when Argentine lay snuggled up to Sudwest. The people listen and filter back to cave and bed and family calabash from which the milk unconsecrated is swallowed in cold whiteness, cold as the north. So, between these two, even routine greeting does not pass without some payload of meaningfulness and the hope of blitzing the other's mind. Enzian knows that he is being used for his name. The name has some magic. But he has been so unable to touch, so neutral for so long. Everything has flowed away but the name. Enzian, a sound for chanting. He hopes it will be magic enough for one thing, one good thing when the time comes, however short of the center. What are these persistences among the people, these traditions and offices, but traps? The sexual fetishes Christianity knows how to flash, to lure us in, meant to remind us of earliest infant love. Can his name, can Enzian break their power? Can his name prevail? The Erzschweinhöhle is in one of the worst traps of all, a dialectic of word made flesh, flesh moving toward something else. Enzian sees the trap clearly, but not the way out. Sitting now between a pair of candles just lit, his gray field jacket open at the neck, beard feathering down his dark throat to shorter, sparser, glossy black hairs that go running in a whirl, iron filings about the south pole of his Adam's apple, pole, axis, axle tree, tree, Omumborombanga, Mukuru, first ancestor, Adam. Still sweating, hands from the working day gone graceless and numb, he has a minute to drift and remember this time of day back in Sudvest, above ground, participating in the sunset, out watching the mist gather, part fog, part dust from the cattle returning to the kraals to milking and sleep. His tribe believed long ago that each sunset is a battle. In the north, where the sun sets, live the one-armed warriors, the one-legged and one-eyed, who fight the sun each evening, who spear it to death until its blood runs out over the horizon and sky. But under the earth, in the night, the sun is born again to come back each dawn, new and the same. But we, Zone Hereros, under the earth, how long will we wait in this north, this locus of death? Is it to be reborn? Or have we really been buried for the last time, buried facing north, like all the rest of our dead, and like all the holy cattle ever sacrificed to the ancestors? North is death's region. There may be no gods, but there is a pattern. Names by themselves may have no magic, but the act of naming, the physical utterance, obeys the pattern. Nordhausen means dwellings in the north. The rocket had to be produced out of a place called Nordhausen. The town adjoining was named Bleicherode as a validation, a bit of redundancy so that the message would not be lost. The history of the old Hereros is one of lost messages. It began in mythical times, when the sly hare, who nests in the moon, brought death among men, instead of the moon's true message. The true message has never come. Perhaps the rocket is meant to take us there someday, and then moon will tell us its truth at last. There are those down in the Erzschweinhöhle, younger ones, who've only known white, autumn-prone Europe, who believe moon is their destiny. But older ones can remember that moon, like Njambi Karunga, is both the bringer of evil and its avenger. And Enzians found the name Bleicherode close enough to Blicker, the nickname the early Germans gave to death. They saw him white, bleaching and blankness. The name was later Latinized to Dominus Blickero. Weismann, enchanted, took it as his SS code name. Enzian was in Germany by then. Weismann brought the new name home to his pet, not showing it off so much as indicating to Enzian yet another step to be taken toward the rocket, toward a destiny he still cannot see past this sinister cryptography of naming, a sparse pattern but one that harshly will not be denied, that cries and nags him on, stumbling as badly as 20 years ago. Once he could not imagine a life without return. Before his conscious memories began, something took him in and out of his mother's circular village far out in the cacao veldt, at the borders of the land of death, a departure and a return. He was told about it years later. Shortly after he was born, his mother brought him back to her village, back from Svakopmund. In ordinary times, she would have been banished. She'd had the child out of wedlock by a Russian sailor whose name she couldn't pronounce. But under the German invasion, protocol was less important than helping one another, though the murderers in blue came down again and again. Each time, somehow, Ensign was passed over. It is a Herod myth his admirers still like to bring up to his annoyance. He had been walking only for a few months when his mother took him with her to join Samuel Maherero's great trek across the Kalahari. Of the stories told about these years, this is the most tragic. The refugees had been on the desert for days. Kama, king of the Bechuanas, sent guides, oxen, wagons, and water to help them. Those who arrived first were warned to take water only little by little. But by the time the stragglers arrived, everyone else was asleep. No one to warn them. Another lost message. They drank till they died. Hundreds of souls. Enzian's mother was among them. He had fallen asleep under a cowhide, exhausted from hunger and thirst. He woke among the dead. It is said that he was found there by a band of Ovatimba, taken and cared for. They left him back at the edge of his mother's village to walk in alone. They were nomads. They could have taken any other direction in that waste country, but they brought him back to the place he'd left. He found hardly anyone remaining there. Many had gone on the trek. Some had been taken away to the coast and herded into kraals or to work on the railroad the Germans were building through the desert. Many others had died eating cattle, dead of rinderpest. No return. 60% of the Herero people had been exterminated. The rest were being used like animals. Ensign grew up into a white-occupied world. Captivity, sudden death, one-way departures were the ordinary things of every day. By the time the question occurred to him, he could find no way to account for his own survival. He could not believe in any process of selection. Njambi Karunga and the Christian God were too far away. There was no difference between the behavior of a god and the operations of pure chance. Weismann, the European whose protege he became, always believed he'd seduced Ensign away from religion. But the gods had gone away themselves. The gods had left the people. He let Weismann think what he wanted to. The man's thirst for guilt was insatiable as the deserts for water. It's been a long time now since the two men have seen each other. Last time they spoke was during the move from Peenemünde down here to the Mittelwerke. Weismann is probably dead by now. Even in Südwest, 20 years ago, before Ensign could even speak his language, he'd seen that. A love for the last explosion, the lifting and the scream that peaks past fear. Why should Weismann want to survive the war? Surely he'd have found something splendid enough to match his thirst. It could not have ended for him rationalized and meek as his 100 glass bureaus about the SS circuit, located in time and space always just to miss grandeur, only to be in its vacuum, to be tugged slightly along by its slipstream, but finally left to lie still again in a few tarnished sequins of wake. Bürgerlichkeit played to Wagner, the brasses faint and mocking, the voices of the strings drifting in and out of phase. At night down here, very often lately, Ensign will wake for no reason. Was it really him, pierced Jesus, who came to lean over you? The white faggot's dream body, the slender legs and soft gold European eyes? Did you catch a glimpse of olive cock under the ragged loincloth? Did you want to reach to lick at the sweat of his rough, his wooden bondage? Where is he? What part of our zone tonight? Damn him to the knob of that nervous imperial staff. There are few such islands of down and velvet for him to lie and dream on, not in these marble passages of power. Ensign has grown cold, not so much a fire dying away as a positive coming on of cold, a bitter taste growing across the palate of love's first hopes. It began when Weismann brought him to Europe, a discovery that love, among these men, once past the simple feel and orgasming of it, had to do with masculine technologies, with contracts, with winning and losing. Demanded, in his own case, that he enter the service of the rocket. Beyond simple steel erection, The rocket was an entire system, one, away from the feminine darkness, held against the entropies of lovable but scatterbrained Mother Nature. That was the first thing he was obliged by Weissman to learn, his first step toward citizenship in the zone. He was led to believe that by understanding the rocket, he would come to understand truly his manhood. I used to imagine in some naive way I have lost now that all the excitement of those days was being put on for me, somehow, as a gift from Weissman. He had carried me over his threshold and into his house, and this was the life he meant to bring me to. These manly pursuits, devotion to the leader, political intrigue, secret rearming and naughty defiance of the aging plutocracies all around us. They were growing impotent, but we were young and strong. To be that young and strong at such a time in the life of a nation. I could not believe so many fair young men, the way the sweat and dust lay on their bodies as they lengthened the Autobahn's day into ringing day. We drove among trumpeters, silk banners impeccably tailored as suits of clothes. The woman seemed to move all docile, without color. I thought of them in ranks, down on all fours, having their beasts milked into pails of shining steel. Was he ever jealous of the other young men, the way you felt about them? Oh, it was still very physical for me then. But he had already moved past that part of it. No, no, I don't think he minded. I loved him then. I could not see into him, or the things he believed in, but I wanted to. If the rocket was his life, then I would belong to the rocket. And you never doubted him? He certainly hadn't the most ordered personality. Listen, I don't know how to say this. Have you ever been a Christian?
Well,
at one time. Did you ever, in the street, see a man that you knew, in the instant, must be Jesus Christ? Not hoped he was, or caught some resemblance, but knew. The deliverer returned and walking among the people just the way the old stories promised. As you approached, you grew more and more certain. You could see nothing at all to contradict that first amazement. You drew near and passed, terrified that he would speak to you. Your eyes grappled. It was confirmed. And most terrible to all, he knew. He saw into your soul. All your make-believe ceased to matter. Then what's happened since your first days in Europe could be described in Max Weber's phrase almost as a routinization of charisma? Autase, says Ensign, which is one of many Herrero words for shit, in this case a large newly laid cow turd. Andreas Orukambe sits in front of any army green, wrinkle-finished transmitter receiver rig off in a rock alcove of the room. A pair of rubber headphones covers his ears. The Schwarzkommando used the 50-centimeter band, the one the rocket's Hawaii 2 guidance operated on. Who but rocket maniacs would listen in at 53 centimeters? Schwarzkommando can be sure, at least, that they're being monitored by every competitor in the zone. Transmissions from the Erdschweinhörer begin around 0300 and run till dawn. Other Schwarzkommando stations broadcast on their own schedules. Traffic is in Herrero with a German loan word now and then, which is too bad since these are usually technical words and valuable clues for whoever's listening. Andreas is on the second dog watch now, copying mostly, answering when he has to. Heeing any transmitter is an invitation to instant paranoia. There springs into being an antenna pattern thousands of square kilometers full of enemies out in their own night encampments in the zone, faceless, monitoring. Though they are in contact with one another, the Schwarzkommando try to listen in to as much as they can. Though there can be no illusion about their plans for the Schwarzkommando, still they are holding off, waiting for the optimum time to move in and destroy without a trace. Enzian believes they will wait for the first African rocket to be fully assembled and ready for firing. It will look better if they move against a real threat, real hardware. Meantime, Enzian tries to keep security tight. Here at the home base, it's no problem. Penetration by less than a regiment would be impossible. But farther out in the zone, rocket towns like Celle, Enschede, Hachenburg, they can pick us off out there one by one. First a campaign of attrition, then a coordinated raid, leaving then only this metropolis under siege to strangle. Perhaps it's theater, but they seem no longer to be allies, though the history they have invented for themselves conditions us to expect post-war rivalries, when in fact it may all be a giant cartel, including winners and losers both, in an amiable agreement to share what is there to be shared. Still, Ensign has played them off. The quarreling scavengers, one against the other, it looks genuine enough. Marvy must be together with the Russians by now, and with General Electric, too. Throwing him off the train the other night bought us, what, a day or two? And how well have we used the time? It comes down to this day-to-day knitting and unraveling, minor successes, minor defeats. Thousands of details, any one of which carries the chance of a fatal mistake. Ensign would like to be more out of the process than he is, to be able to see where it's going, to know in real time at each splitting of the pathway of decision which would have been right and which wrong. But it is their time, their space, and he still expects, naively, out comes the white continuum group past hoping for centuries ago. The details, valves, special tools that may or may not exist, Erdschweinhöhle jealousies and plots, lost operating manuals, technicians on the run from both east and west, food shortages, sick children, swirl like fog, each particle with its own array of forces and directions. He can't handle them all at the same time. If he stays too much with any, he's in danger of losing others. But it's not only the details. He has the odd feeling in moments of reverie or honest despair that he is speaking lines prepared somewhere far away. Not far away in space, but in levels of power. And that his decisions are not his own at all, but the flummeries of an actor impersonating a leader. He has dreamed of being held in the pitiless emprise of something from which he cannot wake. He is often aboard a ship on a broad river, leading a rebellion which must fail. For reasons of policy, the rebellion is being allowed to go on for a bit. He is being hunted. His days are full of narrow escapes which he finds exciting, physically graceful. And the plot itself, it has a stern and intense beauty. It is music. A symphony of the north, of an Arctic voyage, past headlands of very green ice, to the feet of icebergs, kneeling in the grip of this incredible music, washed in seas blue as blue dye, an endless north, vast country, settled by people whose old culture and history are walled off by a great silence from the rest of the world. The names of their peninsulas and seas, their long and powerful rivers, are unknown down in the temperate world. It is a return, this voyage. He has grown old inside his name. The sweeping music of the voyage is music he wrote himself so long ago that he has forgotten it completely. But now it is finding him again. Trouble in Hamburg. Andreas is scribbling away, lifting one earpiece back, smock, damp with sweat so that he can be on both ends of the link at once. Sounds like it might be the DPs again. Got a bad signal. Keeps fading. Since the surrender, there have been these constant skirmishes between the German civilians and foreign prisoners freed from the camps. Towns in the north have been taken over by displaced Poles, Czechs, Russians, who've looted the arsenals and granaries and mean to hold what they've taken. But nobody knows how to feel about the local Schwarzkommando. Some see only the ragged pieces of SS uniform and respond to that one way or another. Others take them for Moroccans or Indians drifted somehow over the mountains from Italy. Germans still remember the occupation of the Rhineland 20 years ago by French colonial units and the posters screaming, Schwarze Besatzung am Rhein. Another stress in the pattern. Last week in Hamburg, 2 Schwarzkommando were shot. Others were badly beaten. The British military government sent in some troops, but only after the killing was over. Their main interest seemed to be in enforcing a curfew. It's Anguruve. Andreas hands over the earphones and swivels to roll out of Ensign's way. Can't tell if it's us they want or the oil refinery. The voice goes crackling in and out. 100, maybe 200. So many. Bulls, clubs, handguns. Bleep and a burst of hissing, then in laps a familiar voice. I can bring 12 men. Hanover's answering, Ensign murmurs, trying to sound amused. You mean Josef Umbindi? Andreas is not amused. Now, Angurube calling for help is neutral on the Empty One's question, or tries to be. But if Umbindi can bring a relief force to Hamburg, he may decide to stay. Hanover, even with the Volkswagen plant, there is only a stepping stone for him. Hamburg would give the Empty Ones a stronger power base. And this could be the opportunity. The North ought to be their native element anyway. I'll have to go, handing the phones back to Andreas. What's wrong? Could be the Russians trying to draw you out. It's all right. Stop worrying about Chicherin. I don't think he's up there. But your European said him. I don't know how far to trust him. Remember, I did hear him talking with Marvey on the train. Now he's with Ticcherini's girl in Nordhaus, and I mean, would you trust him? But if Marvey's chasing him now, it might mean he's worth something. If he is, we're sure to see him again. Anthean grabs his kit, swallows two pervitins for the road, reminds Andreas of a business detail or two for tomorrow, and climbs the long salt and stone ramps to the surface. Outside, he breathes the evergreen air of the Harz. In the old villages, it will be the time of evening for the milking. The first star is out. Okanumaihi, the little drinker of sweet milk. But this must be a different star, a northern star. There is no comfort. What has happened to us? If choices have never been our own, if the Zone Hereros are meant to live in the bosom of the angel who tried to destroy us in Südwest, then have we been passed over? Or have we been chosen for something even more terrible? Anthean has to be in Hamburg before another spearing of the sun. Security on the trains is troublesome, but the sentries know him. The long freights are rolling out from the Mittelwerke day and night, carrying A4 hardware west to the Americans, north to the English, and soon, when the new map of the occupation goes into effect, east to the Russians, too. Nordhausen will be under Russian administration, and we should have some action then. Will it give him a chance at Chicherin? Anthean has never seen the man, but they are meant to come together. Anthean is his half-brother. They have the same flesh. His sciatic nerve is throbbing now, too much sitting. He goes limping, alone, head still down for the low clearances back down in the Erzscheinhöhle. Who knows what waits out here for the head held too high? Down the road to the railway overpass, tall and gray in the growing starlight, Anthean is heading into the north. Just before dawn, 100 feet below, flows a pallid sheet of cloud, stretching west as far as they can see. Here are Slothrop and the apprentice witch, gaily tripping, standing up on top of the Brocken, the very plexus of German evil, 20 miles north by northwest of the Mittelwerke, waiting for the sun to rise. Though May Day eves come and gone, and this frolicking twosome are nearly a month late, relics of the latest Black Sabbath still remain. Kriegsbier empties, lace undergarments, spent rifle cartridges, swastika banners of ripped red satin, tattooing needles and splashes of blue ink. What the heck was that for? Slothrop wondered. For the devil's kiss, of course. Gaily snuggling, oh, you old silly, up to his armpit there, and Slothrop feeling a little icky and square for not knowing. But then he knows next to nothing about witches, even though there was in his ancestry one genuine Salem witch, one of the last to join the Susperkall crowd, dangling, several of them back through the centuries' couplings, off of the Slothrop family tree. Her name was Amy Sprue, a family renegade turned antinomian at age 23, and running mad over the Berkshire countryside, ahead of crazy Sue Dunham by 200 years, stealing babies, riding cows in the twilight, sacrificing chickens up on Snod's Mountain. A lot of ill will about those chickens, as you can imagine. The cows and babies always somehow came back all right. Amy Sprue was not, like young, skipping Dorothy's antagonist, a mean witch. She headed for Rhode Island, seeking some of that asylum, and she thought she'd stop by Salem on her way. But they didn't like her style, and they didn't like her smile, so she never saw that Narragansett Bay. They busted her for witchery, and she got death. Another of Slothrop's crazy kinfolks. When she was mentioned aloud at all, it was with a shrug, too far away, really, to be a family disgrace, more of a curiosity. Slothrop grew up not quite knowing what to think about her. Witches were certainly not getting a fair shake in the 30s. They were depicted as hags who called you dearie, not exactly a wholesome lot. The movies had not prepared him for this Teutonic version here. Your kraut witch, for example, has 6 toes on each foot and no hair at all on her cunt.
That is how the witches look, anyhow, in the stairway murals inside the one-time Nazi transmitter tower up on the Brocken here. And government murals are hardly places to go looking for irresponsible fantasy, right? But Gailey thinks the hairless cunt derives from the women von Beiros drew,